Podcasting from London, Ontario, Canada, this is The Lovers, The Dreamers, and You. An interview show where creative people talk about what inspires them to pursue their dreams and do what they love. And now, your host, Karis Thomas.
Welcome back, listeners, to The Lovers, The Dreamers, and You. I'm your host, Karis Thomas. And if you're joining us, then you are hopefully following us on the web at loversthedreamersandyou.com. And hopefully following us on Twitter, Lovers Dreamers the letter U, and maybe even you found us on Facebook. Please do a search for all of those if you haven't, and feel free to share it and spread the love around of the Lovers, the Dreamers, and You. Wow, that's a whole lot of love. Anyway, here with me today is a fabulous Elizabeth Newman, and behind the producer's mic, as usual, is Luke Bainbridge. Say hi, Luke.
Hello.
And now we're going to say hi to Elizabeth. How are you today, Elizabeth?
I'm great. Even better now that I'm the fabulous Elizabeth Newman.
Of course you are. You're fabulous. You're fabulous for so many reasons, which we're going to get into today.
My goodness.
We like to make our guests feel fabulous.
I love it.
So we'll start with that adjective and we'll go from there. So I'm going to start off today, Elizabeth, by asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. It is radio, so if you can say a little bit about where you came from, what your loves and desires are in your creative world, and kind of how you wound up onto the squishy couch opposite me today.
The infamous squishy couch.
Yeah.
So I grew up in New York City, born and raised, and from when I was very little, my costume box very quickly grew into studying theater at Yale, and then going to film school at BU. Something that I'd love to say is one of my best friends, Talia Klein, who is a great theater director. She and I, when we were in third grade, we took it upon ourselves to organize something called Theater Group, which met on Fridays after school. And we wrote, directed, and produced a play, which went up in my living room.
Nice.
And invited our third grade class.
And to your living room.
To our living room. Yep, exactly. Sweet. Set up chairs. And there was a dot matrix printer that Talia made a bunch of programs on,
with
the little squares that make up images. And I was in charge of props and costumes. And it was great. It was a great theatrical success. We found ourselves, probably a decade and a half later, writing fundraising letters for a play in New York called Clocks and Whistles, which is an American premiere of a play by the British playwright Samuel Adamson. We were writing fundraising letters in the same living room, a decade and a half later. We're like, oh my God, now we're doing it professionally. It's like a New York premiere, and New York Times came on first preview night.
Wow. And so from your living room with grade three with dot matrix printers to your living room many years later with the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly.
That's me. I also love that she mentions dot matrix printers and explains them to someone whose original programs were done by pen or typewriter. Know what those are, folks? Yeah, I do.
I know, right?
We've now set what decade each of us are in.
Right, exactly. I know. I'm aging myself here.
That's all right. You're talking about dot matrix printers. I'm talking about, the Gutenberg press. Anyway, so the New York Times came, so you've come to that point.
Anyway, so Clocks and Whistles was a great production. But I guess Talia and I both like to sort of talk about that doing theater and then doing film for me is sort of just a natural extension of, as I said, my costume box, sort of just what it's always been sort of a part of me.
I'm remembering my tickle trunk. I had a tickle trunk.
Right,
and that's so great.
And it's like it turns into a wardrobe.
It just
the
gets
wardrobe
huger.
Department. And,
yeah.
And I still have, a costume trunk in my basement.
And now you have a new little person to play with.
Exactly.
It's awesome.
Yeah. She'll have to learn how to stand up first. Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You can dress her
Halloween
up.
Socks.
Yeah. I mean, she's here in time for Halloween when
you
can put it on her.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Pose her for pictures.
She will love costumes.
Listen to this later, Isabel. You'll understand.
Isabel, for all of you out there, is she'll be 7 weeks old tomorrow.
Wow.
So many years of Halloweens and costumes ahead.
Yes, many, many. So you went to theater school and film school.
I did.
Can you tell us about that? I mean, first going to Yale for theater school, and then what made you choose to switch and go to film school? Like, did you finish one and then go do something else? Can you tell us all about that?
Oh, sure. So as an undergraduate, I did theater and art history, a double major.
Nice.
So Yale is known for the drama school, which is their graduate department, but there is some overlap with the faculty. Yale does not say that it's a conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liberal arts. So
okay.
It's a lot of theater history as well.
Right.
I mean, I was a performance major, so a lot of my, like I said, oh my God, my Yale education is I'm crawling on the floor and doing like, oh, relaxation
right.
techniques, right?
Sure.
You know? What are all the chemical engineers doing right now?
Yeah. Wishing they were with you.
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. They didn't get to pretend they were reptiles.
No, they did not.
Maybe they were creating reptiles or something.
Maybe.
So I was a double major, which for me was great because it was theater, performance, acting, but then for art history it was a lot of analysis of composition of frames and describing, like thinking in terms of visual, like visual critique or, you know, describing paintings. So for me, sort of the film was the marriage of the two of those.
Right.
I also studied dance when I was younger at Martha Graham, who's a sort of one of the mothers of
yes.
modern dance.
Yeah.
So at the Martha Graham School for many, many years. So for me, sort of choreography was a big part of that. So I actually started doing, did theater in college or at university. I'm American, so we say college, for meaning university. It's very confusing.
This is an international radio podcast show. People will be listening all around the world,
well,
right?
Wonderful.
Right, Luke?
Oh,
we
yeah.
have loads of listeners, so
yeah.
it's good for us to
the
clarify.
One Japanese word I know, Ohio. Good morning.
Nice.
So actually, as an undergrad, I started with a friend of mine, or sort of revamped a film production organization. It's called University Pictures, which Jennifer Beals actually started many, many years ago, the
really?
Actress Flashdance, yes.
Cool.
So it was sort of lying fallow, so we got it back together and wrote, directed, and produced films. We had a little Bolex camera and would do films, and then we organized film festivals at the end of each semester to sort of showcase our stuff.
Nice.
And other films that other filmmakers at Yale had
right.
were making.
Invite people in.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay.
And so so it was while I went to college thinking that I was going to be a lawyer, but pretty soon after
you were studying dramatic arts and
well, I was going to be a political science double major with theater.
Okay.
And then by sophomore year, constitutional law was like definitely my least interesting class.
Right.
And it was a big moment of, okay, am I going to go on a traditional track or like am I jumping off, you know?
Mm-hmm. Was there something that I was just reading about this kind of thing today? Was there something specific that happened? Was there a moment in class? Was there a day where you woke up in a cold sweat going, I can't do this, and you switched? Or do you know? Do you remember?
I think it was, I won't say like a gradual process, but mm-hmm. it was a little bit of just sort of listening to myself and like mm-hmm. really just listening to what it was that I was really passionate, you said new passions, but like what it was that I was really passionate about and what mm-hmm. of my classes, what I found most interesting and didn't just to sort of appeal to me like in an intellectual way, but
right. Compelling.
Kind of a compelling, sort of a deeper,
sure.
a deeper way. I think it was scary because it was like, yeah, the truth is coming out.
Yeah.
Like I could be a lawyer,
but
that's
not
really, really me.
Yeah.
We talked a bit with our last guest, Aaron, about this kind of thing too, about doing art, how it's like the way I would categorize it is like it's like a leap of faith. Like you can't take no for an answer once you choose this path.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be an artist. You're going to keep doing art.
Yeah.
Is that the way you feel about it too? Like, because if you don't have that conviction, it's really hard to make a success out of it. Like,
yeah, no, it is sort of a leap of faith. It's It's sort of trusting yourself in that you're, I remember like after, again, sort of one of these moments was between undergrad and I went directly to film school for graduate school for MFA.
Okay.
But there was a point then too that I was like, okay, well, I really like art history. Like, am I going to go to graduate school to, you know, do a master's in art history? Cause that's a little bit safer.
Right.
But that was sort of another one of these moments of like, oh God. Like,
sorry. A master's in art history is safer than a master's in film.
Well, you know, not really, but, but it is, it's like, you know,
just that tiny bit more, right?
Yeah.
tiny bit more respectable.
Somehow safer, but again, not as true to really what it is that
I love how you said you were listening to yourself, because I'm from Alberta. I did studies out there at college, and then I went to British Columbia and I was accepted to university there and then didn't wind up going and all of this sort of stuff. And then I was here in Ontario, in Toronto, and I was at a performance of Giselle watching Karen Kane dance. And Karen Kane has written that it was watching someone else dance Giselle when she was really little that she decided that's what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I was sitting there finally, because I my whole life wanted to see Karen Kane dance, and I finally got to see Karen Kane dance. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there in the audience, and I was profoundly sad and profoundly filled with joy at the same time. And I was there by myself, and there were two older ladies sitting either right beside me or right behind me, you know, something like that. And we wound up talking because there was no one else in our section of the theater. And I was telling them my story and how I'd always loved to see her dance. And I was so thrilled. And they'd seen her dance hundreds of times because, you know, they were of that kind of age. And by the end of the performance, my brain was talking to me saying, "You're an idiot. Why are you not doing this? This is what you know you want to do. Go back to school, you fool. Go now." And so I just went, okay, that's gotta wonderful. Listen. Yeah. So mine kind of moments are usually pretty profound, emotional, you know, smacks in the face with a wet fish. Because I guess
as long as it's not a stinky wet fish.
Well, I guess I ignore that little voice for a long time until it finally shouts at me. So I like that you're saying that it was a lot of slow listening to yourself.
I do actually, now that you mention dance, there was a moment when I was in high school, because I did sports too in high school, but when I sort of came back to doing theater, and actually I saw a friend of mine who's like the, you know, school dance concert, Sidra Bell, who actually is now a choreographer in New York. Beautiful, beautiful dancer. I remember she was dancing a solo at the, you know, Spence dance show. I remember just watching her dance, and she moved so beautifully, and it moved me to tears, because she's that kind of highly trained but also emotionally connected dancer, which is sort of, you know, elevates it from.
Sure does.
And I just remember saying to myself, "Oh my God, I want to make something beautiful."
Mm.
So I did have, you know, it that was like one of the little steps along the way.
So it was just a little fish.
It was a little fish. It was like a minnow that smacked me kind of like on the cheek a little bit.
But it's just like, hello, pay attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine are very large. Luke is enjoying that metaphor. Whale.
Yes, very much.
Yeah. I don't know where that came from.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have a barracuda in the face.
So I love that you're the first American that we've had. You won't be the last one. We have one other one that is already scheduled. We're very excited about that. Spoiler alert. No, it's coming soon.
We're keeping it under wraps.
Yeah. We're terribly excited.
Mysterious American people.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that because you grew up in New York and you have all these connections with people who are creative and they've now moved on. I almost feel like there's 6 degrees of separation from what you've done or who you've met or who you've worked with. And can you illuminate? Can you talk about any cool people you can stick? Well, she's smiling and nodding at me. There's someone in particular, but if there are others,
leading question.
If there are others other than this particular Muppeteer person that we're alluding to, you don't have to speak just about that person.
Okay. I will talk to you about Frank Oz because I know that's what you want. But
drop lots of names.
Oh no. Okay. Actually, sort of a really interesting experience I had when I was in New York before I moved to Los Angeles was I'd been interning or working at a interning and then working at a film production company in New York called Belladonna, and they were producing, or one of the producers of Michael Haneke's movie Funny Games, which is it was the American remake of his German language film that he had done a couple years beforehand, maybe 10 years beforehand. And it's a really, really, really dark,
scary,
film. Really, really scary, dark,
perfect
movie.
For this time of year.
Yeah. But not like creepy as in like, ooh, that's a good scary. It's like it, he sort of calls attention to
dark and sinister
to violence and mm-hmm. how corrupt basically American cinema is in reveling and enjoying violence. So the story of Funny Games is there's this lovely couple who has a son, and they go to their country house, and then these two very polite young men proceed to and torture this family. So, you know, really broad comedy, right? Belladonna were, the company was one of the producers on the film. And so I was Tim Roth's assistant on the movie. And I learned a lot from him. Well, I learned a lot sort of watching Haneke work and, you know, with the translator. And so it was Tim Roth and Naomi Watts and Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett and this wonderful, wonderful little kid who's, yikes, not a little kid anymore, named
I know, how dare
Devin.
They?
My job was to sort of help Tim decompress after mm-hmm. after them. I mean, get him lunch and stuff like that too, but he was pretty low maintenance, but because the movie was so dark, there was the like sort of resurfacing after the day's shoot of like, you know, sit and have a drink and talk about anything else but the scary movie, because they didn't shoot entirely in sequence, but it was like as it progressed it gets darker and darker and darker and darker. And so
like
as we
movie.
Were working on it, sort of, you know, we started out shooting out in the Hamptons, and it was like lovely and sunny, and mm-hmm. a lot of days they were like driving around in a car and I was hanging out in his trailer, like, I don't know, organizing stuff. And then when we moved into the studio in New York, it was like what the actors had to go through each day was mm-hmm. more and more
sinister and
and emotionally devastating. Mm-hmm. But I remember Tim actually was saying to Brady one day after shooting, because they were talking, because he was saying, he's like, oh, you know, I play the villain a lot, right? Like,
right.
He said, in this one, he's not the villain. The two boys, Brady being one of them, were the villains. And he said, so your job as the villain is just to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's my job to be afraid of you.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be scary or act villainous.
Right.
It's your job is just to, you know, be who you are and believe what you believe and be your character. It's my job to be afraid.
Right.
I thought that was a really interesting little nugget that I've stored away.
That's a really interesting characterization of evil. Like, I don't know. I find that because that's exactly what's so scary about evil people is that they believe what they're doing
for
wholeheartedly,
sure.
And there's nothing you can say to sway them, and so all you can do is be afraid of them.
Well,
scary. Yeah.
The bad guy in any story doesn't think of themselves as the bad guy.
Exactly,
they just aren't, and it's how the rest of us react that tells the story.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly,
and that tells the characterization. Remember, we'll digress here, and mention when we did Three Musketeers, Luke and I. Our friend Kate played Milady de Winter. And when Kate was first playing the role, you know, she and I talked quite a bit and how she said, I really want to get into this lady and I don't want her to be two-dimensional and I don't want to do anything I've done before.
Yeah.
And I'd worked with her a fair bit. So she said, you know, free rein. If I do anything that looks, you know, like a caricature or like it's a copy of anything I've done before, you nail me on it. And so I did. And she was great because she began to realize, and she and I, in investigating Milady de Winter, we realized Milady de Winter has reasons for everything she's done.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And they're completely valid for Milady de Winter. Mm-hmm. And it became so completely emotional for Kate a few times to touch those places and realize, you know, because it's so easy to go, okay, I'm playing the bad guy.
Here's my mustache. So I'm going to twirl. Yeah.
Right. And then when we got to a few points and I was like, okay, when he says this to you, that's insulting. And here's why that's insulting. And she was like, oh my God. And I remember one particular rehearsal where like some welled up, some tears came and she needed a minute. And she was like, no, no, this is good. But I just need a minute so that I can go and process this and contain it and then use it.
Yeah.
There was just one amazing scene in particular that really always affected her. And when she had the big confrontation with her ex-husband in the play, and like that scene every time, I don't know, I like, it was really interesting to watch everyone, like her reaction to it and stuff, and realize that Milady, she, you know, she's the villain, but there's a lot of backstory that you're that you need to be open to.
And so, the student performance, they all had that wonderful reaction, you know, because Milady has to die, and they all had that wonderful reaction when she comes out to kill her second last victim, or her last victim, and they see her coming and they're like, turn around, and they're trying to, you know, because they're grade 3 and 4, that sort of thing, right. And then when Carrie Hishon, our other guest host, manages to kill Milady de Winter, you know, great cheers and whatnot. So there was that reaction, that sort of two-dimensional reaction. But then there were lots of other audience members. This doesn't come across in the audience, but they would talk to her afterwards, or they'd talk to me afterwards, and it's like, Milady is a very misunderstood person.
Oh, wonderful.
And so it was
success,
yeah,
right?
So that big success for her. Interestingly, all of those people were women.
Yeah.
So interesting. But yeah, that's totally like, Tim is obviously, he's a great actor. He's obviously right on the button with just do what you're supposed to do, because he as the victim represents how the audience is supposed to see.
Right. How the world is affected by a character.
Because if it were a different film, if it was another villain with another villain, well, they'd perceive him in a completely different way. It'd be a different film.
Yeah.
Hence Sweeney Todd. Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
That's not a very nice person.
Sweeney Todd just creeps me out.
But you're supposed to persuade him. Be persuaded by him.
Mm.
So any other names you want to drop? Other than the big one that we've asked you to drop?
I will say I've learned also a lot from a good friend of mine, Doug Lyman, who's a director. And I've sort of gotten a chance to watch like a little bit here and there on sets, like a movie Jumper, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been, I remember I was producing another play in Los Angeles called Orange Lemon Egg Canary. Somehow I only work on things that have a really long, complicated name, like Goodnight Children Everywhere, Orange Lemon Egg Canary, one was Knights of Noir.
So goal in Texas is to produce something that has one word.
Exactly. Exactly.
And not supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, you know, nothing
that. One short word. Maybe I'll do Pinter's Betrayal.
There you go.
Done.
Simple word.
But I remember we were, so Orange Lemon Egg Canary is about a play about, there's about a magician, and sort of magic as a metaphor for love and manipulation, and you know, is love only an illusion? And it's beautiful, beautiful. Rinna Grof is the playwright, and it's a gorgeous, gorgeous play. This one I was producing and acting in, not directing. But we had a really, it was in LA during the Screen Actors Guild. No, sorry, it wasn't SAG. It was the Writers Guild strike.
Mm-hmm.
But because the writers were striking a few years ago, basically all work stopped everywhere because everybody, you know, all the other guilds and unions.
Yeah, supporting them, yep.
Exactly. And so, you know, in LA, you'd think it'd be easy to find a magician because there's this place called the Magic Castle, which is a magician's club, which is awesome. It's one of the coolest places in the world.
Clearly have to take my husband there.
Oh, you do. You do. It's amazing. It's a sort of very old school club where you have to wear a jacket and tie and or cape.
Right? Nice.
It has the best dress code ever.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Google the Magician's Club.
The Magic Castle.
The Magic Castle. I'm sorry. It is a club.
It is a magician. It is a magician's club. And so they have, you know, magicians are doing close up magic for each other. They have dinner there. The show's going on.
Nice.
Imagine like Harry Potter, but real, sort of.
Yeah.
And magicians, not wizards.
But the Lovers and Dreamers and You field trip.
No, totally. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Magic Castle.
Okay.
But so because that's there, and you would think that we'd be able to find.
Yeah, walk in. Is there a magician in the
right,
house?
Right. So, but because it was the strike, a lot of people who were magicians and actors were having. They couldn't afford to, you know, take a month off to be in rehearsals for, you know, a teeny budget play, because they had to make their money being magicians, because they didn't have their, because they weren't making any money being actors.
Right. Sure.
So we were having a terrible, terrible time. I remember talking to Doug on the phone and sort of just like asking him, like, you know, so talk to me about failure, right? And here he's, you know, directed tons and tons of, you know, the First Bourne movie and all sorts of other movies. I remember he said, you know, I mean, he said, you know, everybody, you fail all the time. You fail all the time.
Yep.
Like, you know, he's like, my first movie, total failure. I don't think it was, but, but, you know, he's like, what really matters is what you do with it. Right.
Right.
If you, like, just like get up and like, what do you do next?
Right.
And, you know, it's not something that, you know, you can read sort of books about it, but it was meant a lot to me to hear from somebody who, you know, is clearly like very like successful.
But that he considered he had so many failures.
Or that he understood, and that I think the reason he is so successful is because he has not let any sort of failures define him, or
right.
or it doesn't, the story doesn't end there.
No, he's learned from them.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what I was gonna say. Like,
yeah,
a big personal philosophy for me is that, like, as long as you learn from something, it's not a failure. You can never fail at anything as long as you take something away from it. Sounds like that's kind of what he was saying.
I mean, exactly. And he was like, you know, just and get up and keep going.
Yeah.
Can you imagine some of the greatest minds that we have, like, if they didn't succeed the first time around? Like, Mr. Steve Jobs wasn't doing so hot there for a while.
Yeah.
If he'd just given up.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he learned from all of those
things. Where would podcasts be? We'd be lost.
That's true. There'd be no pods to cast.
Yeah.
They'd be called something else.
Yeah.
They'd be bigger and bulkier, maybe.
Oh, come on now.
Less pretty. I don't know. Wow.
Boombox casts.
Yes. Right. Yes. Somebody else would have been able to name
We'd
us.
Just be standing
the hi-fi cast. Yeah. Yeah.
It could be a spinoff show.
Yeah.
It could be.
Retro.
Yeah.
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 So Frank Oz.
Yeah. Yeah, we're dancing around this.
The Muppety Frank Oz. So when I was in grad school, I worked on the movie Stepford Wives, the remake of sort of with a comedic twist that Frank Oz was directing. Over the summer, I was one of the 100 of Stepford Wives, where you sort of check in the morning. They'd hand you your eyelashes to put on, and you spend an hour and a half in hair and makeup, or like just basically hair, because right, everybody had to look perfect because
right.
we were all robots, and wearing very high heels, and they'd put sort of body paint on to give everyone a slightly unnatural skin tone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this one particular scene that we were working on was at a square dance. So it was a big square dance. So there's Nicole Kidman and Bette Midler and Glenn Close and everybody, all the doing, and
all
Matthew Broderick, all doing
square dancing. Stuff.
And Faith Hill was in the movie as well, playing one of the wives. But they had a body double for her because her character goes like spinning out of control.
Oh,
so,
okay.
The Liz was the name of the you know, stunt double.
The body double stunt double.
And so, and it's like, sort of this in the scene, like she goes like turning around the room. So she was like spinning Liz, right? So it took like 2 days to shoot this. So then Frank Oz would sometimes, in a very Muppety voice, being like, spinning. I can't do the voice, but he'd be like, spinning Liz. And then
spinning Liz.
Yeah. And so as she was, you know, spiraling out of control.
So just, we're all now imagining the voice of Yoda saying spinning Liz
exactly.
Liz over and over again.
Yeah. And that was, everybody got a big kick out of,
nice.
Out of that. And then later on in the fall, because this movie shot forever, like literally the call sheets, you know, usually have it as like, you know, day 30 out of 50 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was like day 100 out of ?
Wow.
By the end. because they sort of had to keep redoing the ending. We were in Connecticut at this old mansion called the Lockwood Matthews Mansion. And so I took some time off of school to work on the film, kind of as a liaison between the mansion and production, which was great. It was sort of like to keep an eye on the set. Basically, there was these antique music boxes that we had to make sure that the grips didn't mess with the music boxes as they were bored. But a lot of my job was like literally just to stand there and watch Babysit. What was going on, which was awesome for a film student.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing to to watch Frank Oz work, because he just was a lovely, lovely person to everybody mm-hmm. on set. He just was very kind and courteous, and he had a great rapport with Mark Catone, I think was the name of the first AD.
Mm-hmm.
That was always like, "Here you are, sir. Thank you, sir." You know,
right?
But it was very cool to watch Nicole Kidman work as well, because she,
oh, really?
She worked really hard. Same thing with Tim and Naomi and Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett. They all. It was amazing how great they are. Like how. People who are, they're famous, but just to see, not, that they're serious all the time, but just how seriously they take
what they're
their
doing.
Work. Yeah.
Right.
And how generous they all were as people too.
I think a lot, I know a lot of great actors from around here, but I think a lot of what separates the famous people from, the people who fizzle out is work ethic, putting in the long hours and being such a great, generous person to be around. So,
well, and I wanted to ask about that, because obviously, if we haven't mentioned already, Elizabeth is a director and has just finished a successful production here in London before she leaves us. But watching film actors working, is there a huge difference between how they work to how stage actors work, because of the schedule and the demands and the way things are not chronological, or do you find it the same?
That's a really good question. On Funny Games, I remember just in terms of, as you're saying, work ethic, I remember there was one shot where Tim literally had to fall down 50 times. So it's like, he gets hit in the knee and falls, mm-hmm. As part of the story. Sort of without complaint. I mean, mm-hmm. it was like, boom, down. Okay, do it again. Boom, down.
Right.
It was literally like, take 45, take 50. He didn't lose his cool. He just did it because that was his job.
Because that's his job.
Yeah. We had, in college, we had Frances McDormand actually come speak to our film organization. She said, and I think this is sort of the truest version I've ever heard of how to describe film acting versus stage acting.
Okay.
She said, it's the same muscles that are working. But in stage, it's heavy lifting. Whereas in film, it's like, isometric or whatever, that's just a very, it's the same, it's coming from the same place, it's the same muscle, but instead of it being a large movement or sort of a large presentation of it, it's just a very, very fine, it's you turn the eyes instead of turning the head,
right?
But it's coming from the same mm-hmm. place, it's the same origin, the same mm-hmm. muscle that's working.
Wow.
But I thought that was a great way of describing it.
Yeah, I've always thought of film as more calculated. Like, when I watch movies and stuff, I don't know. Like, I only started acting in Three Musketeers, which was, 2 years ago now?
Three
Septembers ago. And that was really an eye-opening experience for me, because I've always thought of acting as these, minor things you do, that, give off emotions, and on stage, it's not it at all. Because there's some... Then if you just, move your eyes, the person in the back row sees nothing.
Right. You have to play to the back of the house.
Exactly.
And Three Musketeers was a pretty broad comedy, so was Treasure Island. So, mm-hmm. And then you went and did The Fantastic. So you've done three broad comedy roles
and
in
The Fantastic's where I was the comedic relief.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point too of what is the tone of the piece, right? Because that that changes both on stage and in film.
Well, and Goodnight Children Everywhere was in the Pruquigny Hall, which is easily one quarter the size of the main stage at the Palace.
Yeah. Right. It's very much more like
and the audience
acting.
Was like 3 feet away. And the subject matter.
Yeah, I was going to say the tone was completely different. Like, right. I think it's the first play I've seen that was so intimate like that, that it was the kind of acting I was used to, where like I could read Anne's face from the back and I could see all the emotions right there in front of me. Yeah. You know, it was a lot more subtle than what I was used to, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Yeah.
Well,
made me
you.
Wish I had auditioned.
But we had you doing our sound.
Yeah.
Well, and we had to find people. So it was timing or something. It's getting harder and harder to get people to come out for shows. Not to come out for shows, but that there's so much more competition here in town, and you have to plan so far ahead. Otherwise, you know that one actor you really hope for is already going to be booked.
Right, which is great that there's so much theater going on, right? It's
this is a great town for, I think, the arts community here. It's great. Yeah. I love it. I'm getting more and more involved in, even with like the visual arts and stuff that are happening here. And I don't know. I really like it here. I like the fact that we can do plays like Goodnight Children Everywhere and have them sell out nights, and then plays like Treasure Island, same thing. Like
also
it,
sell out. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Like
very different plays. Yeah.
We have a good audience here, I think.
Yeah.
So.
And we're just building.
Yeah, which is great.
So to tie into the question of comparing film and stage acting, or to jump off it rather, you're about to embark on all kinds of crazy adventures. We've mentioned Isabel, who's only about to be 7 weeks old, and you've just sold two houses, and you're about to pack your whole life up and traipse back across the border.
Heading to Texas. Yeehaw.
And then heading to Texas. I mean, could not be more different from where you are right now. But, you know, eventually that craziness of moving and all of that creativity, because let's not negate it, it's certainly creative doing all of that stuff.
Creative problem solving.
Yeah. Well, and creating life.
That's true.
Creating
that's true.
A person.
My best production.
Yes. Yes. But if you had to, if somebody, you know, a couple of years from now, once you're settled and whatnot, walked in and plunked down a big wad of cash in front of you and said, you can make one project, a film or a play, but only one. I'm only going to fund one. What would you pick? And why would you pick that?
Well, how big is the lump of cash?
It's a big lump.
It's unlimited.
It's a big lump. Right. You should have seen her face when I asked that. I wish I could do vision on the radio because, wow, her face did so many, like, how do I decide? It's a big lump. It's a big enough lump to do whatever you want for film or whatever you want for stage.
Okay. Because usually, you know, for film budgets, you just add some zeros compared to
the
theater
budget.
Sure,
but this is Texas. It's a big theater that we're going to produce whatever your magnum opus is.
I think that's a very good question. And by that, I mean a very difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
I think my, and I'm sort of going to like, I'm going to be very, very much a politician and dance my way around.
That's
it.
All right.
Because I think that I would love, in my ideal world, for the actual medium to be film.
Okay.
But I would love to have it with a rehearsal process, or because I'm in Canada still, process of being theater, because I do love rehearsing with actors, and I really do love working with actors. And film, I love with sort of using the camera, as I said, I used to dance and that.
Yeah.
And so it's very much like staging for the camera is very much like choreography.
Mm-hmm.
And using the camera to help tell the story visually. This, which is part of the reason that I like doing theater that's small, like Goodnight Children, and that it does have a similar intimacy of film, is that, you know, it doesn't have to be broad. It can be subtle. It can feel naturalistic. The audience is right there to sort of witness life unfolding, as opposed to like da-da-da, spangles and banners and jazz hands.
Which are great.
You know, it's a great entertainment.
All the stuff that I do.
Which is I love to go watch that stuff.
But well, that's, I think that I'm doing all of those types of shows because of the choreographic eye. That's why I get asked to direct them, because they are basically, it's a playwright who's written a film and he likes to think that it's a play. It's not. It's a film. And now I have to try to make it happen on stage.
I think one of the stage directions in Treasure Island was Jim jumps and then it goes into slow-mo, like, or something, wasn't it? Like,
he jumps, nay, he soars over, or something ridiculous like that. It's like, are you kidding me?
We love you, Ken Littering.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
Yeah, when I produce Sullivan and Gilbert this spring, that will be the trilogy of Ken Ludwig, no more.
Yeah.
Like George Lucas, I've done 1, 2, and 3. That's it. We're done.
Done and done.
Yeah. Yeah, I will not go back and do prequels.
Yeah. But I wanted, hold on, I had a quick question.
So she should have done a play
and
then done a film documentary of the play. And that's how you could have spent the money. And
that's true, except that documentary is definitely not my
thing. No.
But you see, it would be like a rehearsal process.
Right.
That's what I was going to ask, was in film, there's not a lot of rehearsal processes, or like, if any, or...
I think it totally depends. I mean, I have not yet directed a feature. That's... Yeah.
Well, see, I recently saw a movie called People Like Us, which was directed by Alex Kurtzman, the guy who writes like all these major blockbusters like Star Trek, and he did Lost, and he's doing a bunch of new superhero movies. It was his first feature he directed, and I guess he rehearsed for months beforehand with the actors, and it said that was really weird. People don't do that. I'm like, seriously? Because I would like a lot of the,
I think there are some, I think there's some directors that are able to sort of snag some rehearsal.
I think it's
like
if
stuff is low budget, right? Like if stuff is low budget and your actors are available, then, you know, sometimes you can do sort of a Cassavetes thing and take a year to shoot a project. But you know, if it's like, okay, well, so and so is, you know, available for, you know, 1 week, right, you have to shoot those days.
Those scenes.
That's almost upsetting to me, because it feels like I don't know, like a play like Goodnight Children Everywhere, where it was all emotional nuance and stuff, that took probably the months to build it up to that. And it feels like I guess a good enough actor, maybe that's why they're paid so much and so professional, because they can pull that out just by reading it and come in and do a week of shooting. But I don't know.
Yeah,
which feels like you're missing something.
No, it's true. I completely agree, because even it was interesting for Goodnight Children, right? We just did a week of table work to sort of be like, what is going on in this play,
right?
And then blocking the scenes and working, and then because it was like my little mini maternity, having a baby leave for 2 weeks, we
2 week maternity. Wow.
Yeah.
Don't spoil yourself.
And she was a week late too. So. We had the actors sort of go away and learn, like we blocked the show beforehand and did one on book run beforehand, which was great. Everyone was very happy. I was especially like happy. I had had a nightmare, I think, in the last weeks of rehearsal before having Isabel, where I was like, I was on an airplane. I was like, is this plane going to land before I have my baby? And like, clearly the plane was like, you know, will this show get blocked before, you know, was my water going to break in the middle of rehearsal? But it was great to have. So in those 2 weeks when they sort of, I was, you know, off doing my thing and had the actors get together and do run lines and do Italian runs and sort of just spend some time getting to know each other. When we came back after the hiatus, it was amazing to see just how much the relationships between the characters had deepened as the actors themselves got to know each other, as they had some time and space to themselves to really to run the lines together, to like sort of sink into the characters. And it was amazing to see just that, is, you know, like the layers of the onions, like we were getting into the deeper layers. And as, you know, as through the, you know, I would have loved for it to have been, you know, a 3 month run, because I would have loved to see, what kind of shenanigans they'd start pulling.
It'd have been farther away to closing night.
Yeah. Right, exactly. You know, I do think that's part of the joy of theater is that you have time to really sink your teeth in more and more and more.
Well, and when you interview when you watch interviews of people who have had that opportunity in a film, when they've gotten to rehearse with someone, they say exactly that sort of thing. They say how luxurious it was, how it felt so good to get to know the other characters and really get into it. I think sometimes in the big blockbusters where there's all the fight scenes and all of that, they get some of it just from that rehearsal, because you can't just walk in and do those things.
Right.
Yeah. But for the more intimate things that don't have people blowing up and cars running over things, if they get a chance.
Intimate car chase, no.
Yeah, there's a challenge. But if they get that chance with the director and the other actors to really, you know, go over something, they really find, and they always say that this was such a joy to get to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Very cool. Well, I mean, we could sit here and discuss film and process and mistakes. And
I think we may have to line getting Elizabeth smacked up for like a Skype while she's in fishes. Texas.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I'd love to Skype with you guys.
Yeah. We do try to keep our little show here to sort of a manageable, listenable time if you're driving to work. I hope hope you're enjoying our little discussions. So, sadly, we're going to have to say goodbye to Elizabeth, not just from today, but from London. And I certainly hope from the people here in London and in the theater community that you come back to us at some point.
Yeah. I would love to.
And in the meantime, I wish you all the best with your travels and your adventures and getting Elizabeth and Brian and the dog and everything across the border.
Thank you.
And I certainly hope this isn't the last we see of you. And we're going to do a transition to whatever our mystery song of the week is.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Because we kind of sprung it on her, so we'll... Right. It's as much a mystery to us as it
means
to you.
That means I have to think of one right now.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Oh, so shortly, you will hear us singing something totally off the top of our heads. Thank you for joining us once again. We are the Lovers, the Dreamers, and you.
Bye.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do.
Dancing is allowed, they can't see us.
Okay.
This will all be on the show.
Yeah. Ariel, listen to me. The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything. They got up there.
Seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more is you looking for?
Under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore they work all day, out in the sun they slave away, while we devoting full time to floating under the sea.
Down here all the fish is happy, as off through the waves they roll. The fish on the land ain't happy, they sad cause they in their bowl. But fish in the bowl is lucky, they in for a worse fate. One day when the boss get hungry, guess who's gonna be on the plate?
Oh, under the sea. Nobody beat us, fry us and eat us in fricassee. We what the land folks love to cook.
Yum!
Under the sea we off the hook. We got no troubles, life is the bubble. Under the sea. Since life is sweet here, we got the beat here naturally. Even the sturgeon and the ray, they get the urge and start to play. We got the spirit, you got to hear it. Under the sea.
The news play, the flute, the cop play, the harp, the police play, the bass and they sound and chop. The bass play, the brass, the chop play, the tom. The flute is a duke of soul.
Yeah.
The ray, he can play, the lings on the strings. The trout rocking out, the blackfish he sings. The smelt and the sprat, they know where it's at. And all that blowfish blow.
Yeah.
Thanks, Quake, for the fishing.
Yeah.
Under the sea, where the sardines in the bikini is music to me. What do they got? The lapis sand. We got a hot crustacean band. Each of the clam here know how to jam here under the sea.
Each of the slug here cutting a rock here
under the sea.
Each little snail here know how to wear here.
That's why it's hotter under the water.
Yeah, we're luckier down in the muck here under the sea.
Thanks for joining us at The Lovers, The Dreamers, and You. We'd love to hear from you, and you can do that at thelovers, thedreamersandyou.com or by finding us on Twitter or Facebook. This has been a Luke Bainbridge production. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, and we'll see you next time for another edition of The Lovers, The Dreamers, and You.
Life's like a movie, write your own ending. Keep believing, keep pretending. We've done just what we've set out to do. Thanks to the lovers, the dreamers.